This episode is brought to you by Not Alone Co. It has been such a pleasure for us at Not Alone Co. to create our little Not Alone community. We want to be able to utilize the messaging on our apparel in order to help facilitate tough and meaningful conversations with your loved ones. Community, conversation, and vulnerability. This is a journey, and mental health isn't a battle to be won. We at Not Alone Co. are here to remind you that you are never alone, and it's okay to not be okay. Use code NAC10 at checkout for 10% off your order, which helps us donate portions of the proceeds to various mental health charities and foundations. That's code NAC10 at checkout. We love you, and you're not alone.
All right, everybody, we're back. Start off with just a hard-hitting question. When you eat bacon, do you like it crispy or soft?
Duh. My instant analysis goes to like a BLT. Like, do I want my bacon soft or crunchy in a BLT? Like, crunchy bacon hits different sometimes. But also, like, if it's too crunchy and then it's just like, you just tap on it and it breaks. Like
a Holiday Inn continental breakfast piece of bacon that's been sitting there all day.
Yeah, that's stuck what I together think with like three more pieces of bacon. Yeah. Uh-huh. This is going to be weird, but I'm like, soft bacon guy.
Yeah.
sounds horrific.
I'm soft bacon too. Like a little bit of char, a little bit of fry, but floppy.
How do you like your eggs?
Scrambled. If I have toast, then I might go over easy. So they're a little dippy. I dip the toast in.
Can you eat a hard boiled egg?
Oh yeah. I like hard boiled eggs.
I can't do it. Like I can do any other form of egg, but like the last time I just bit into like just like a straight hard boiled egg, you know, the classic like you where you almost throw up, like that happened, and it's been a while since I've done that. So anyways, welcome back to another episode of the Speak Your Mind podcast powered by Torch Pro. We are back. The sun is shining. It's gorgeous outside. My name is Riley Cheyenne, and joining with me, as always, my guest or my co-host, Tyler Smith.
Did you do that on purpose? You're an idiot.
We have an amazing guest for you guys today. Alicia Nasser is a behavior analyst, PhD, and works with high-performance athletes, works with hockey players, but also has worked with Silicon Valley individuals and people that are at that Fortune 500 and high up. And I think, you know, it's so refreshing to hear a perspective that you just sometimes don't get as much in your life as you would. And Alicia's was exactly that. Like, I think the way that she can formulate the reframing of your mind, the process of that relationship with your thoughts and the fear of failure and the shame and everything. I mean, I'll let you guys listen, but I know we had a blast with Alicia.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I think the conversation will speak for itself. Just being able to understand like how your brain works and your thought process through different situations and stuff. It was really cool. So yeah, it was just a really good one, a lot of fun, and we'll let you dive in.
And as always, the Speak Your Mind Instagram is a place where, you know, we hang out every once in a while. New Tune Tuesdays. We got a new series coming out, Lick and Kick Fridays. So please, head on over. Say hello. Let us know what you're into. Let us know what you're listening to. Let us know what you don't like. And just remember to speak your frickin' mind. And we love you. And enjoy today's episode with Alicia Nasser. Well, first off, thank you so much for joining us. But where are you now and how have you been?
I've been well. Currently, I'm in Michigan. Location-wise, I'm in Michigan. I'm often between Michigan, Boston, Miami, what have you. So I travel pretty often. I've been well. Do you want me to introduce myself, my credentials a bit? To kind of
yes. Yep. Like, yes. Give us the alphabet.
I'd be like, you know, Alicia, she doesn't have the alphabet. Should we hear her before? So I'm Alicia Nasser. I am my PhD, I actually just finished my PhD. It is in applied behavior analysis, which is a subdomain of psychology, actually more of biology, it's a behavioral science. So it's really the understanding of organisms and human behavior and why we do what we do. And understanding the conditions in our environment that cause us to do what we do, and looking for patterns in behavior. And when I say behavior, that also includes thought. A lot of times when you say behavior, people just think outward behavior. So I'm a board certified behavior analyst, which is the certification you need if you are studying applied behavior analysis and you want to practice clinically or if you want to do research. So So my PhD is in applied behavior analysis. I'm a board certified behavior analyst. And I'm also an international behavior analyst, so I can practice outside of the country, which I often do, in all of the countries around the world. And I work with the general population and individuals who are looking for mental health support, whether they be high performers in terms of Fortune 500 companies and CEOs. I work with a lot of people in Silicon Valley. And then I, as of the past 7 months, started working with pro and elite hockey players, which has been very interesting and very cool. And my work primarily revolves around two different domains. One is more tactics and strategy in terms of, like, so I'll just stick to hockey for now, on the ice, like teaching coaches and players different tactics and strategies to use based on like schedules of reinforcement. So you can actually shape up the behavior of shooting a certain way or skating a certain way. Increasing speed is a big thing these days because everyone's skating super fast. And
Not me.
Some of us here.
Those hips are barking, Riles.
Yeah. All right. Sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
Okay, I love that. But, you know, there are ways to use behavioral principles and apply them to coaching strategies. On ice and also off ice, but it's very cool to do it on ice. So I do that. That's one domain of the work that I do in hockey is using these behavioral principles and applying them to the game to optimize a player's game or team dynamic in general. And that's like, we could do a totally different podcast on that. It's not really mental health related. It's more behavioral principle and shaping up behavior. Then the other domain is the emotional well-being. The terms of these are different than conventional. I try to stay away from the word mental. And I realize we talk about mental health, but it does have this slightly negative connotation to it. And we'll talk about the power of language. Yep. I would prefer to use emotional well-being and emotional turbulence and psychological agility. Those words are, first of all, more like agility, flexibility. A player can relate to them a bit more, right? And they're less harsh on the ear in terms of stigma. And so it allows for the conversation to flow a bit more. So that's the other subdomain is that entails a bunch of subdomains of like emotional awareness, self-awareness, self-esteem, and your inner critic and all that kind of stuff. So the other area of my work focuses on that with players, but also with coaches, which has been interesting. We might have to do another episode on that because, you know, there's this whole thing about coaches as well, struggling with their own emotional well-being because they also have a lot of pressure. So that's who I am. It's what I do professionally, but there's a lot of other personally that I do. I love to play tennis. I'm all over the place in the summertime, especially outside. Huge Formula One fan, but that's really what matters right now.
I think it's awesome how you talk about like almost like you don't use the word mental because even like we've spoke about sometimes the language in the space is intimidating and sometimes people hear it and they automatically run away. Yeah. Like if they hear, even for us, like we talk about trying to help this space and like sometimes you get caught using like that end the stigma, like normalize the conversation. And as much as those phrases, they mean a lot and they go a long way and they're very wordy and sound nice, but it's also like, you want people to just feel comfortable kind of dealing with what they're dealing with and not thinking of it as something that should be a bad thing, you know? So I think that's cool. And I wonder if that, is that like a reason why you use that verbiage?
Huge. So the best example of this is the word death. The second you say death or dying, people, you just, I mean, I just say it and you feel a thing, like viscerally, it's a thing, you know? And so we make a thing out of words because they are a thing based on our history of learning. So my research, my dissertation focuses on the power of language and cognition and the meaning we give to words. And actually, my dissertation research, a specific study, I ran a protocol for athletes and hockey players on the link between heart rate and self-critical descriptions, because self-critical descriptions are just words. So I wanted to see essentially how impactful are words to a player's heart rate, because as we know, if you can regulate your nervous system, you can optimize the game a bit more because you can think more strategically on the ice. But if we have this barrier and this imposed pressure of words that just, we're always thinking, there's always a narrative, a conscious stream of thought going on in our head. And so if words have so much power, so as to change how we feel, literally, viscerally, then that has a lot of implications for how somebody plays the game, what they can do to regulate themselves. So words have power, and the primary focus of my research is on language and cognition and the meaning we give to words. So like I just said, the word death, it has like that thing. The same thing, a most common example I use is the word lemon. I don't know if you guys saw, I had posted something about this, but if I say the word lemon, you don't even have to see a lemon, taste a lemon right now. You just kind of like, you know, like that's supposed to show the little physical effect of words, right? And so that's actually where a lot of depression and anxiety comes from, is the meaning we give to words and then over time, the physical experience that they have on us. And I think the same thing is true for what you're saying is like word mental and stigma. Because we think like mental institution, like that's what somebody thinks, mental institution, you know, and stigma just automatically implies something must be different or wrong or unique about this thing because we're saying it's a stigma. So there's so much power in language. And it's interesting because initially I was very reluctant to study this because I was like, power in language sounds so woo-woo. It sounds so cliche. And I'm like, oh, it's actually fucking true. Can I swear?
Yes, absolutely.
It's true. Like even like that's why we have swear words too. Like there's power in swear words. So the whole, I guess, to bring it home and kind of full circle it is we think in terms of words. When we speak in words and work in our critics and our narrative in our head is all words that we use, all language. So there's power in language. It's like, don't think for a second that the power of language isn't any less significant or impactful when it is a thought in our head, because that's what it is, you know? So it's like for players on the ice, or even when we're talking about retirement, right? Like, maybe just all of us were talking about retirement and other players I was speaking with, and actually retired players now. It's like the word retirement, even like it has this huge weight of losing your identity and attachment to a thing that has been your whole life. And like, then you're like, who am I, you know, at all? And then it's like, what's my self-concept? What's my identity? And these words, they have so much power because they dictate the meaning that we give to ourselves and like the world. And I could keep going, so I'm just going to stop there. But you guys take it from where I'm going to go with that.
No, I think, it's so true. Like now being through so much grief, I think even in that space, like grief terminology and like grief language is such a powerful thing because I mean, even grief, like you say the word grief and being in a conversation with somebody who maybe doesn't understand your grief or your loss. I mean, there's such an intimidation about going about that conversation and like having proper grief language to be able to express your love or your, you know, care for that individual is challenging because you want to say the right thing, but then you're just biting your tongue at the same time. And it's such an interesting balance, but I kind of want to just touch on like, why athletes, you know, you said you've worked Silicon Valley, like big wigs, like people that are high up. And now you're going into a space, like especially hockey players where the mental side is not really, I don't know, like hockey players are mentally strong, but like emotionally strong is a whole different ball game. So why athletes or why hockey players?
Well, that's a great question. From an entrepreneur standpoint, business standpoint, it's a great market.
We're all messed up.
It's a fantastic market. You know, I don't know if you guys like follow Alex Hormozy, but he was like, you might have a market problem. And I was like, fucking right, I have a market problem. Because the thing is this, the general population, even those Fortune 500 CEOs that I work with in Silicon Valley, and I'm sure some of them will somehow find this and listen to it, but because they all just like, all of my current clients are connected to all of my stuff. But this is nothing they don't know because I say it to their face. The thing is, the general population, they want to change, but they don't want to change. They want to talk about changing. They don't want to do it, right? And what I found with athletes is like, they want the edge. They want the thing that's going to give them the edge, you know? And when I realized that, it was like, I love helping people. I love doing what I do. And I want to help people who want to be helped. And it's not necessarily help. It's more so redirection. I don't even want to say help. I just want to say like redirecting you, like guiding you and leading you towards action, value-aligned actions and behaviors and thoughts, because that's going to get you where you want to be in life, right? And for like players, especially going D1 pro, there's a lot on the line there. It's like, well, this is going to make or break my career. This is going to make or break like my path forward. Like, what am I going to do? You know? And so they're willing to invest in that. And they want the help. They want the edge. So that's why market, from an entrepreneur standpoint, it's a great market. And There was one thing that you mentioned. You said, mentally strong and emotionally strong. I actually would push back on that and say, it's the language there. Like, that's the language piece. And my very first post ever, which is the one that made me realize, like, oh, I should probably keep going with this, was a post that said, it was like, PSA, male athletes don't need resilience training. Like, they don't need mental toughness training. What they need is emotional regulation, and they need emotional understanding. Because you don't, the mental toughness thing, it's like, fuck that. We don't need that. What we need, because what happens is if you're mentally tough, it implies you don't process your shit. It implies you don't process what's going on internally. And that's part of the problem. We tell men in general to begin with in society not to show anything but toughness, and to show, don't show when you're weak, don't show when you're sad or you're lonely or you feel isolated or you're depressed. And that's where we get addictions from, is when we tell them not to express those things, then they're going to go try to just like fix the pain internally elsewhere in an unhealthy way, right? And so the mental toughness thing isn't so much what is needed. What's needed is an awareness of the mental landscape and an awareness of how to navigate the mechanics of the mental landscape and the emotional mind. Being emotionally aware and emotionally tough are two different things. Because if you're emotionally aware, then you have the coping strategies and the tools in your arsenal necessary. You have the same skills, like you have skills on the ice and skills in S&C training that you do for your mind to navigate that stuff, you know? But mental toughness actually, to me, seems like weak, because it's like tough is not actually navigating it. Tough is maybe avoiding it. And that is a dangerous place to be.
Wow.
It's a very common place, yeah. We should put that on a shirt or a mug or something.
Do you find with your experience, like talking about like being emotionally aware and having like a high emotional intelligence, like sometimes you can be like too emotionally aware and like you can process things where you're almost like you're sacrificing yourself and you're losing out on opportunity where like, is that ever a problem, or is it more just like of a lack of understanding of what's going on in front of you, and you need to work on the skills to be able to process those things? Like, I don't know if it makes sense to you, but guys like too scared to take a risk because they think that their own opportunity is going to be sacrificed if they mess up, which to me kind of sounds like maybe they're a little too aware of what's going on and they have to kind of bring that level down a bit.
Well, what I would say to that, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm not getting the question right, is that if you're not acting because of fear, I actually don't know if you're that aware. Because if you're not acting and taking action despite risk, despite the unknown, I think that not asking is because you don't know your relationship to the unknown. Your relationship to the unknown, you haven't explored it yet. To know that you're uncomfortable with the unknown, you're uncomfortable.
It's like a lack of trust kind of thing.
Yes and no. I see what you're saying. Yes. But it's also attachment to an outcome. And it's also attachment. Mm-hmm. It's attachment to control. And so I think often when I hear you say too much emotional awareness, I see what you mean in terms of you're too scared, because I think you're thinking about all the possible things that could go wrong, all the what ifs. But I think then that actually is a relationship to somebody's fear, or a relationship to an attachment to an outcome and the need to control that they actually probably haven't explored, that they would benefit from exploring it. But I see what you're saying. So it can work in both ways, where non-action is just as important as action. Wherever you're not taking action, you need to look there as well, or it would benefit you. Nobody needs to do anything. Everybody do whatever works for you, but it would benefit you to look there, because there's always a story behind every behavior, behind every thought, behind every non-behavior. There's a story about where that's coming from. And that story is usually, for most human beings and most players, generally, like I'm glad you asked that, because it just made me think of something. But the story is generally one of, we need to stay in familiarity. Don't go into the unknown. I have to control the situation. And I'm like, well, I hate to break it to you, dude, but if the puck goes that way when you wanted it to go that way. Like, I want to say something really quick that I just thought of, but does that kind of answer your question about it?
Yeah. Yeah. The only reason I'm asking is because like I can identify myself as being someone who was scared to take chances. I seem to maybe play more on the defensive side, and I was a little scared to show the offensive side of my game. And I saw it with other players too. But then you have guys at the other end of the spectrum where all they want to do is offense. They're just sacrificing the defense to just score, score, score. But then that ends up hurting their game. So it's like finding that middle ground. And I think a lot of it too is coaching, helping you to give you a little kick in the ass to say, okay, you can do this. Like, you can start venturing outside of your comfort zone. We know you're going to be strong defensively. And then on the other side, like, hey, take a couple steps back. Like, we know you have the offensive talent, but we need you to be a little bit more defensive. So I just like wonder how that plays into the emotional awareness piece.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Two things on that really quick. It doesn't matter. I get what you're saying about the coaching. But the interesting thing is if a coach goes, or coaching staff is like, hey, we know you can do this. We know you can do this. Like, you got it. Like, they're trying to, you know, just pump you up based on the research and based on, you know, there's some outliers. But it actually doesn't matter what coach says or what anybody says, because what happens is an athlete needs proof of the thing that they can execute the skill. They need proof of it. So the best way, this is like a little pro tip for coaches, is if you actually want a player to be able to execute skill, stop talking. Stop talking. Create an environment and a situation where they can execute it and they can contact reinforcement by actually doing that skill correctly, and then they'll do it. Because what happens is we humans need proof of everything. We're ridiculous. We need proof that we can do the thing. Because if a coach is like, you can do it, you're like, no, I freaking can't. You know, like, I was an elite gymnast, and there were so many times where my coaches were Russian and Yugoslavian, and they were like yelling at me and cussing at me in other languages. And I was like, dude, it was like, you know, Russians, hockey and gymnastics, it's their thing. And so I was like, I don't care how many times you say this, I'm not going to do a triple double in the air because I'm going to land on my net. But then the one time I did it, I was like, shit, I can do it, you know? So
yeah,
that's one piece, just a little pro tip. But it's interesting. I had a player who during playoffs was telling me he needed to switch something up about his game, and he knew he needed to do it. And we were speaking about it, and I was like, well, why are you hesitant to do it? Like, what's the barrier stopping you? And he goes, I need to do what I know I can do. He goes, I'll work on that during the off season, but I can't do that right now. If I do that and I don't do well, and I'm like, okay, well, we have two options. You don't do the thing, and then you're not doing the thing you should be doing because apparently you need to be changing this aspect of your game. Or you keep doing what you're doing, which is not in the direction where you want to be going because you should be doing something else. So either way, you lose. It's like a risk-benefit analysis, right? So a lot of times it's about like common sense. And sometimes common sense is not so common, but that's because the brain is hardwired to focus on the negatives and not the positives. So we look for all the ways that things are going to go wrong. Because it's evolutionary speaking, it like protects us. I get it. But like then it gets to a point where like, all right, dude, we are not chimpanzees anymore. We gotta put it together. We're fine. Like, what's gonna move you towards what you want and be more practical with that? You know, does that kind of
Yeah, no, 100%.
I think it's fear of the unknown that could hold a player back with their skills, and not taking those chances that you're talking about, like offense, defense, whatever way you need to go. It's fear of the unknown. I think it's an inability to trust in your ability to navigate it if it doesn't go well, and to not let it inflict wounds on your self-esteem.
Yeah, and that's just like a life thing too, right? Like, it's probably why a reason someone doesn't lose weight or someone doesn't change the job that they're in, because they're uncertain of what's next.
For sure. I think it's also easier to stay the same. We love, just piggybacking on that, you're 100% right. And also we love familiarity. We love comfort. Yeah. So we'll just stick with, but that's not, you know, you don't grow there, but
yeah.
So even like, honestly, even to bounce off that and like that comfort of change and like being able to like embark on the unfamiliar side of things, especially as athletes, like we are such creatures of habit and creatures of routine. And so where do you see that balance? Like you just said, like with change comes growth, with getting unfamiliar with something and with pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone comes growth. Where do you find that balance of, okay, let's get into a daily routine and like, let's create good habits, but also let's find a way to grow still. And let's find a way to embark on these new challenges, and let's find a way to be spontaneous and get outside those comfort zones. Like, where's that balance of, okay, let's have a good routine, but like, let's also push ourselves in a way that our routine maybe doesn't push ourselves.
Yeah, that's a good question. First, I wonder if it's necessary. Like, do players want to do that? That'd be a good question to ask first. But if they did, if the answer was like yes, like I would think more in the off. If, are you talking emotionally or just in general?
I think emotionally, but also just like even for people in general. Yeah.
Yeah. There's two different ways of thinking. And this is probably the best way to answer this question. There's dialectical, like dialectical behavior therapy is a common form of therapy, dialectical way. And then there's dichotomy. Okay. Dichotomy is black and white. Dichotomy is all or nothing. Dialectical is there's gray. It's on the spectrum of this end and that end. There's a little bit of in between. So dialectical can say, I can be grieving and still be happy. I can be have lost somebody and still know that they're with me somehow. I'm a hockey player and I do this. I play hockey and I had a shitty game. I didn't have a good skate and I still can execute skills well when I need to. Like there's two simultaneously opposing things that can exist at the same time, right? And so I think maybe like leaning into that way of thinking as opposed to dichotomy, because then it allows you to get outside of your comfort zone. It allows you to explore and not be so stuck in your routine. Because when it comes to retirement, I will tell you, that is not going to serve. Because you're going to be like, what the hell do I do now? And you know, I'm not even just retirement. Let's say you get injured. You have a career-ending injury. You know, you don't want, that's where it really meant, like, when we're talking about mental health, you can go the wrong way if you don't have other ways of knowing who you are and just existing in the world.
Yeah, because it seems like kind of a scary comparison between those two, because like they both seem to have like you can get positive results from both. Right. Like you see a lot of guys that are so obsessed with the game and they don't have anything else, but they're really, really, really good players.
Yeah.
But like you said, then when that's taken from them, that's kind of when it gets scary. And even like for me, like we talked about like debating retirement, I think I did a pretty good job while I was playing to be interested in other things. And it seems to like give me some peace knowing that, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I've seen the opposite where guys get so tied up in the game and it's all they know and it's all they identify as. And then, like you said, like that's when substance abuse comes out. That's when like, it seems like their relationships fade because like, there's just so much tension in there. They can't continue those. So yeah, I just kind of was highlighting that you can be one and it's maybe not the right way, but you can still get positive results, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a right or wrong way. Who's to say? I think I would say the best way is the one that works for you. You know, it's all it's all context specific and person specific. And that's the other thing is we are all definitely not the same. We're very similar, but everyone has a different story, different history, different background, you know, so it's definitely not one right or wrong way. It's just the most optimal way for
you. Yeah, you put a picture of Roger Federer on your Instagram. It caught me right away when I was scrolling through. And it seemed like...
Have you seen my tattoo?
Oh, nice.
It's his backhand. I don't know if you guys, I was...
Oof. And is that... I mean, obviously, there might be some like attraction there for whatever reasons. But but from like from an athlete standpoint, like I've listened to like some podcasts that talk about his ability to balance everything from the sport to family to philanthropy. And it seems like he's a good example of like, I'm going to ask you again to pronounce that word.
Dichotomy or dialectical.
Yeah. I'm not even going to try to say it, but
no, you can do it. You know what? Actually, that's a really good point. Last night I was at the driving range and after we had some drinks and I was wearing a Roger Federer hat and someone had mentioned like something about him. And I said, I think it's just that he's so well-rounded that he just has, you know, his family, he does other things. Like even when he was playing, like he had all these other identities and these things that he was involved with, you know, because to your point, when you had mentioned, you know, it could go either way because you could be performing well either way. It's like you don't really know though why it is a player is performing so well. You don't know for sure if it's because he's so zoned in and focused that that's all he does. Because there's so many variables, you know, you would have to isolate them. So you can't say for sure it's because they don't do anything else. Mm-hmm. But then we can't say it's not. And I think it's more so about what allows you to live the life that feels good. But if you're just stuck in a routine of hockey all the time, you don't know that. And I don't think that doesn't mean you're any less dedicated to your career or the game at all by any means. And I don't think that that should be something that coaches or scouts or organization should ever consider, like, oh, well, he's not serious. It's like, no, dude, he is. He's also just a human first, though, you know?
Right.
I just had a thought kind of disperse here, because we had a discussion a while back, and I personally think tennis players are the greatest athletes in the world. Like, just like an all-around athlete, like, I think tennis players are it. But then, like, now I'm flipping, because Riley and I both play golf this morning, and I love golf, and, like, kind of same thing as tennis, where I kind of want to flip to mindset now. And with golf and tennis, there's so much quick thinking, but there's also so much quick, like, a relationship with, okay, I just had a failure, I had a mistake, and now I got to get right back to it. Because tennis, like, it's, you're not on a team, it's completely by yourself, tennis and golf. And I think my question is directly related to tennis and golf players, but I'm just more curious, like, how do you prepare that mindset of knowing that fail your head, because there is so much fear of failure, but also rebounding it to be like, okay, like, that's fine. Like, I can get through that mistake, and, like, we're still good. Like, how do you prepare your people or your athletes, or how do you recommend people do that?
Yeah, that's a good point. A couple of things. It's funny, because last night, my friend that I was at the range with, he was like, you should work with golfers. And I was like, nope, we're not doing
that. No market.
And he was like, well, why not? And I was like, because do you know how many hockey players they are? I was like, this is But, you know, because he was saying it because of that, the mindset. So what happened was, is, like, I'm not a very good golfer. I just go to the driving range. I'm not going to hold anybody up. But you contact so much reinforcement when you, like, hit, when you have a good swing, when you hit it, when you hear that, like, swoop, and everything just flows so nicely. So I was like, you know, but it is a mindset thing. Even in tennis as well, like you're saying, the next shot, the next serve, the next hit, to make or break it, your technique, your form, everything could be spot on. It is one negative thought in the wrong direction and you're done, right? But how do you come back from being down? Like, if you know, how do you switch that? Because especially because it's so on the line and the differences are these minuscule differences, right? So what it is you said fear of failure. I would recommend, essentially, my overall arching answer to this would be, first, and this would happen outside of the game, outside of execution of a skill in a competitive situation, is exploring an athlete's relationship to fear. Exploring an athlete's relationship and attachment to the unknown, and exploring the relationship to what we call as failure, but which I would say is a undesirable outcome. I would not say failure. I would say, what is your relationship to undesirable outcomes? And then what do you make it mean about you? How do you let it inflict wounds on your self-worth? And then what do you say about your skill? And what do you say about your chances of doing well in that game or that set if you have an undesirable outcome? An undesirable outcome, does that change all of the years you worked to get to where you are? No, it doesn't change all of that, but it will and it can if you make it mean that, right? So that's like that narrative, that's the inner critic and the self-talk that's going on. That should be explored outside of the game. But especially too, in other, this like translates to every area of life, your romantic relationships, your career, your business, your parenting skills, all of it. Let's say you yell at your kid, you let your some frustration out at your kid, right? And just like every parent does it, it's fine, you know, whatever. But it's like, then what do you make it mean about you? Do you then feel guilty as a parent? Like, do you, what's then happening? Because then whatever's happening, is it going to move you in the direction of the next behavior or skill you want to execute? You know, then that's what you have to ask yourself. Okay, well, is feeling guilty after I yell at my kid going to help me parent better next? Probably not, you know? So what could help you parent better is a choice to think in a different way, reframe it. So then moving on to the next portion of this answer, it's all reframed, right? So a reframe is just reframing a thought. Essentially, if you think about it this way, we all have windows. We see the world through a window. I'm looking outside the window right now. There's a frame around the window. If the frame is dirty, if it's an undesirable thought, you need to change the frame of the window, change the frame of the picture, whatever it might be. Reframe it. Reframe it to one that's more polished and one that serves you in the direction that you want to move in life. So instead of being like, oh, I just fucked up. That was a shitty shot. Like whatever the case might be, reframing it and being like, that was an undesirable outcome, but I know I'm capable of desirable outcomes. Right now, I'm not very happy with myself, and that's totally fine, but I cannot be happy with myself and also execute the skill the same way, back to the dialectical thinking. So it's like, I'm not sitting there telling you that you have to be happy with the fact that you just missed a shot. I'd be pissed at myself too. You can be pissed at yourself and execute the skill well. Those are two entirely different things. It's about the behavior, not about the person. If you make it about the person, if you make it about you, then you're attaching, first of all, everything that you're going to do with the behavior to who you are. And now you're just doomed, you know? So it's about first starting off again, like just to kind of recap all of that. Changing the relationship and attachment to the unknown into fear, into failure, reframing all that outside, looking at how it shows up in all the other areas of your life as a player. How does it show up how you interact with your partner, with your parents, with your children, in business endeavors, whatever the case might be. Then learning strategies to reframe it in the moment. And then to the point that we started talking about at the onset, what words are you using on the court, on the wherever you are, on the ice? What words are you using in that moment? Because they're viscerally going to make you feel something. And if you need to like get your heart rate back down and get your mind in the zone, well, you can't have a high heart rate. You need to be like, you know, regulating your nervous system and coming back down to homeostasis. But if you say failure versus undesirable outcome, I guarantee you the athlete who says failure is probably going to have a difficult time bringing his heart rate down and getting back in there. Whereas he says undesirable outcome, you know, so that's kind of, that's like key there. Hmm. Last point I'll make say is this, and this is something I want to make sure I touch on, is, and because this applies to everything, is shame. Shame grows in secrecy. When we don't talk about things, shame grows. And shame is, you know, stigma thing in the mental health. It's like when we don't talk about it, it continues to grow. So talk about it. Talk about how, like literally even self-talk. If you're on the court, if you're on the ice, be like, oh, wow, that was a crappy shot, Alicia. Like you should have, well, what was going on there? Like talk to yourself, talk about it and get it out there and reframe it. But then also talking about it, not with a negative connotation or as if you're disciplining yourself or reprimanding yourself, but talk about it as just a thing that happened. Because if you talk about it, it can't grow. It's like, you know, when people, let's say, when there's infidelity, if somebody cheats on their spouse, when somebody does a bad business deal, whatever the situation might be, that shame that comes from that, or like if you were abused as a child, like that was something that was very like personal to me when I started working in this field. Shame from abuse grows because you just don't talk about it. And then it has so many implications in your life. And I know that's like a very large example for this very not so small question, but really is just like talk about the time when you had a bad shot and talk about it in a way where you're just reframing it to move in the direction where you want to go.
Right. I got a question kind of, and it might be hard to answer, but like something like this is for someone who's like new to the space or new to this kind of advice, like to remember to use this language and to go back like inward after a bad shift or whatever, like what is your advice to people to practice it? Because it seems to me like it can be something that's like not easy to forget, but you know, like it's almost like a familiarity thing. Like the way you talk to yourself might come creeping back in, but to be able to be consistent with it seems like it would be difficult at first.
For sure. Good question. I'll just make it super simple. My last answer was not so simple. Get a sticky note and just write reframe. Just get a sticky note, write the word reframe, and put it in all your common touch points. Put it in the car. Put it in the bathroom mirror. Put it in your locker. Put it wherever you are, like on your bag. Put one in your bag. Wherever you are, wherever you go the most, because that essentially, that's what you're going to need the most to see. It's going to remind you. You're not going to be able to do it on your own. You need to be reminded of it. And then eventually what happens is when you see this reframe sticker all over the place, it's reminding you to reframe your thoughts, right? You can even want to write the most common thoughts and the most common reframes. And then slowly you can fade out the sticky notes. You don't need them anymore because you just remember to do it. It's like the most simple way of doing it, because you're right. The thing is, the inner critic just creeps in so quickly we don't even realize it. We're doing it.
Yeah. We'll have to mark this for our listeners and for us. Just a little, you know, a little thing to remember that to be able to do.
Really quickly, it's actually derived from behavioral principles. So prompts are used to increase responding in a certain way. So if you want to increase more positive thoughts, it's called a within stimulus prompt or a within environment prompt. So it's a prompt in your environment that gets you to respond a certain way. So the stick is a prompt that gets you to respond with a more positive prompt.
Writing something on your stick or like on the palm of your glove or something just to kind of give you like a little bit of like between shifts, you put your stick down and you see like reframe or something, then it's like,
that's actually a good one.
I want to ask you about one of your posts, kind of ties into this too. It was about visualization.
Oh yeah.
And sometimes how it can be like prohibitive, because like you hear it so much, like visualize before games and like do these exercises, go out on the bench and just scan the ice and picture yourself in these different scenarios. And I had trouble with that. Like it did seem to spark a little bit of anxiety of like the game starting. And it's not that I didn't want to play, but if I was going to be in it, I wanted to be in it. I didn't want to be like picturing it. I know, like, I don't know. It just seemed like that post was relatable for me. And I kind of was curious about like the science behind it.
Yeah, for sure. No, I'm glad you asked. I got a lot of messages about that post because it's not something you don't know till you know, you know. And a lot of people are like, "Oh, I thought visualization," but then I had some players reach out who were like, "Yeah, I do like get more anxious. Like, I do feel like I'm thinking about this thing." And so essentially, the science behind it is this: to think of a thought or to envision or try to visualize things going a certain way is a really difficult thing to do if it's never gone that way before for you, because you haven't actually contacted those conditions in your environment before. And like I was kind of talking about before, we need proof, like the whole tip for coaches, you know, just don't talk about it, put them in a situation where they can actually do it, is because we need to, the thing to happen, because when the thing happens, the whatever you're visualizing, you contact reinforcement from it when it happens. And that increases the likelihood that an organism or human being will engage in that behavior again. But if you've never contacted it before, it's really difficult to visualize it in a state of like homeostasis where your body's calm. So that's the other point is, if you are anxiety prone or anxious prone, which a lot of players are, they just don't talk about it. We need to talk about that more. They all have, not they all, that's a general statement. But oh my goodness, boys, we need to talk about that. Like, I was going to say, ladies and gentlemen, and ladies, like, yeah, we need to talk about that part more. Is if you're anxiety prone, thinking about a thing that is really, that elicits anxiety for you is only going to elicit it more. So there's like, no, it doesn't seem as though there's any good based on the research. There isn't a ton of good just laying there and visualizing this thing that's already making you anxious when you think about it. You know, it sounds so counterintuitive. Now, if you do want to do visualizations, there are ways in the research to go about doing it. I think I talk about it in that post. But if not, essentially, it should be short and quick. It should not be this 5-10 minute affirmation. Also, affirmations just really don't work. The research doesn't support that they work. You know, it's about, you have to contact conditions in your environment where the stimuli and the response patterns, you've contacted them before and they've produced reinforcement. And when I say that, all I mean is, you've done the thing, you've done the skill, and it worked. Got you the desired outcome. You know, and no visualization is going to get you that. Now, that's not to say, like, it's a terrible thing to do. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, you know, for more bang for your buck. And also, it can have some detrimental effects, though. It can. If you are anxiety prone and you're sitting there. And I just don't think that's as well known, in, at least definitely in the hockey world. There's, like, a lot of visualization coaches. I'm like, yo. We need to kind of rethink that. And I know nobody's ill-intended, but it is something that is really important to think about because it matters, you know?
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, for sure.
Even for, like, manifestation, it seems as though manifestation has been something over these past couple of years that people have really latched onto. And honestly, in some respects, like, I think it's weird to say, but, like, manifesting things in my life, like, it has worked out. And it's interesting... like the parallels between visualization and manifestation. I don't know if you've dove into the manifestations in that whole world and like being able to manifest what you want and being able to manifest things. And I just don't know if there is maybe a play on maybe not visualization, but let's manifest and let's put it out into the universe and let's just see if it sticks. But then again, obviously there's the fear of, okay, well, if it doesn't work on the first time, then it's never going to work. So do you have any, like, perspective on that?
Yeah, I do. And just based off of, it's not something I thought about much, but as a behavioral scientist, my first go-to is just to say it depends on how you're defining manifestation. When I hear that word, my first response is manifestation from a behavioral point of view and behavioral psychology and neuroscience is essentially taking action towards the thing you want.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to sit here and think about a thing and I want it to happen, it's probably not going to happen. You got to take action in the direction towards the things that you want. So when you say it's worked out for you, I imagine that you've had an idea. You've probably written down some descriptive goals or outcomes that you've wanted in your life, in whatever domain that might be. And then you've probably taken action towards those things. The things that you've done in your life, the choices you made, the behaviors you engaged in, got you that thing. You didn't just, I mean, maybe you didn't. If you did, then let me know what you did. But like, I imagine maybe you didn't just think about, you know, an outcome and all of a sudden it was like, oh, here it is. And it popped up in front of you. I think this is how somebody defines manifestation. Like, it can get a little woo-woo, like pop psychology, you know, if you let it. But for me, it's like, if you're manifesting a thing, an outcome that you want, you got it and it worked out for you, but that required of you to take certain steps and actions towards that thing. You know, you didn't just show up at your doorstep for somebody who's like, hey, here's this opportunity randomly. You know, you did some things. Does that answer your question?
Is purpose maybe like a better, like, is that a better word, or is that a word that you use? This kind of ties into Ty's question, I think, and it was something that I wrote down about wanting to ask. I find when I go through a little bit of a reflection period, like finding your purpose, and then the other big word was integrity, like what I'm doing to uphold that, and like if it's what I want, I'm holding myself accountable to those right steps. Like that might be, that could probably run parallel with manifesting something, right? If you're really serious about it.
Yeah, for sure. I think you guys are both, I think we're all saying the same thing, just different words. So actually what I'll say to this is an acceptance and commitment therapy is the primary therapeutic modality that I use. And to your guys' point, acceptance and commitment therapy is all about, and this is, when, you know, Riley, when you're asking me about the frameworks that I use with players, it's this. And there's actually, I have it somewhere, and I did summarize it in an article. It is a study that they did in Stockholm with a pro players using acceptance and commitment therapy. Essentially, it is six different pillars. The main one is your values. What are your values in life, right? And what are you taking committed action? So there's committed action, and then there's inaction. And then there's psychological flexibility, and then there's inflexibility. And it's as though your purpose, like you're saying, and the manifestation piece I would define as the values. You know, what is it that you want? The purpose is a combination of the values that you assign to yourself in life, the things that matter to you. And then the integrity piece is the committed action you're taking to move towards those values. So in acceptance and commitment therapy, it's like, are we taking committed action towards the values that we want in life? And that includes our thoughts though. You know, so if you're a player and you're having a negative thought on the ice, like, is that thought going to move you towards your values and the things that you want? When it comes to purpose and meaning in life, if you're talking about purpose, like your purpose in life, we're always looking for that. You know, we're always looking for life. We're always like, what is our purpose and meaning? And, you know, and it's a tough question because I don't think it's one answer. I don't think it's linear. I think it constantly changes. I think we all want to know that as human beings deeply, because if we can know why we're here and like why we're doing what we're doing, just like what's our purpose, then we feel fulfilled. The biggest thing I find that we feel so uncomfortable with, myself included, is loss of direction. When we don't feel like, where are we going? Like, what am I doing? What's whatever? The number one thing I hear the most, players and athlete, non-athlete, is like, I just don't know what I'm doing with my life. And I'm like, this is it. This is life. Like, this is it right now. This is what you're doing. You're talking to me. Like, this is the thing. You know? And so I don't know if I'm shying away too far away from what you guys are talking about, but this is.
But then you get like, I feel like you get like a validation, but like almost like reassurance when you are doing the right thing. This is just my belief. I mean, I'm not a huge like voodoo-y universe thing person, but I also feel like when you're doing the right thing, eventually you get rewarded, and some not rewarded like from a monetary standpoint or whatever, but you get reward almost with what you're saying about the contact reinforcement kind of thing. Like you feel that sense of good that propels you into keeping the momentum going and wanting to do more of it. So I don't know, I just find like when I'm aligned with the purpose and it feels right, I feel like I'm getting this little feedback every once in a while that it's the right you thing are. and I'm on the right track.
You are, and I would go with that feeling. You are, because
Because what it is, and when we don't have that feeling is when things can go wrong and we feel lost and we're like, what am I doing with my life? But I think, you know,
that
that also gives you information. That's a good point that you bring that up, because it gives you information. It tells you what matters to you. You know, when you're feeling good about it, you feel fulfilled with it, it like tells you what matters to you. And it tells you, like sometimes I even had a lot of players who actually, I mean, and again, I know we're just talking about life in general, but it applies to players as well, is a lot of players like, I don't even know if I want to be playing hockey. And I'm like, let's see how let's open up that can of worms, you know?
Sure. I've had that.
You know? Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's very relatable. And it's funny too, like you talk to, like you even just talk guys like mid-season and they're like,
they're like, what the fuck am I doing?
I don't know. Like we talk about, I've said this like so many episodes, like NHL stands for the Never Happy League. And it's like, I don't know, maybe, maybe we should kind of like try that on a little.
You know, no, but then also, you know what? I've heard it all. Nothing at this point shocks me. And because this, I'll tell you guys, the past, Tyler, I was going to call you before we jumped on and be like, hey, I need a minute to regroup, because the past, I've been having like my own thing lately. But like, you know, you get to an end of something in life, and like the end of my PhD, I'm like, fuck, I worked 12 years for this, you know. And it's weird. You know, all these mixed emotions, just like things are happening. You just like, it's a lot. And I was talking to one of my advisors, and I was like, you know, I know that I have this thing that I'm going to do, but I also just don't know if I want to do it, or like I don't want to do it right now. I don't know. I was just kind of explaining to him like a business idea and what have you. And he was like, I don't think right now you saying you don't want to do it is actually the truth, because I think you're just in a funk when you're saying you don't want to do it. And I don't think that this reason for you to not do it. And so kind of what I'm getting to there is that I think it's okay to be like, do I even want to be playing hockey? Like, why am I even playing? Like, what am I doing? But then also to feel that while you're doing the thing, I think it's normal. Mm-hmm. I think we just need to normalize that too, is to be like, it is totally normal to be full throttle in something and invested, and to also be like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, do I even want to do this
anymore?
You know, I think that's okay. I think when it becomes something to visit, like more seriously and really consider, is when your quality of life diminishes, when your relationships are sacrificed, when you have other priorities. So if you have a child, if you're married, and if you're just like, you know, this is not sustaining financially, if like those things become more real. And I think that's time to like reconsider that. I think injuries, concussions are a big thing we know. Like, you got to think about that long term. So I think it's okay to be in a thing and not know for sure if it's the thing you want to be doing. I think when it starts to diminish your quality of life, and when you're like, all right, dude, I'm over this, then, you know, exit stage left.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. Wow. That was, I enjoyed listening to that actually, because I've had those thoughts so many times of like, that was so great, but why the fuck am I doing that?
This is important really quick, is just to say, I think having that thought and not shaming yourself for it is the most important part. So like, you can be like, what the hell am I doing? Or like, why am I here? I don't even know I'm here. And you can do that without shaming yourself. The second you shame yourself, you tie this limbo-ness of your way of thinking to your self-worth and your identity, and you don't want to do that. So, I mean, all of everything we talked about today is like, the main thing is all these things can happen. All these thoughts can take place, all these behaviors or whatever, these circumstances, these situations. And at the same time, the one thing that has to remain steadfast and true is your self-worth and how you view yourself, your relationship to yourself. So where everyone, anybody listening, like athlete or not, where the very first place to begin is your relationship to yourself and your relationship to yourself concept, because all of these other things could be happening in your life, but you just, that's the thing that has to stay steadfast, because that's like your anchor. It'll bring you, you know, it'll keep you. Yeah.
One question before Ty, one way to do that one effective way to kind of emphasize that is your language, like the way you talk to yourself. Like, I'm just trying to think of like, sum up one sort of bullet point for anyone listening, like some sort of strategy.
Here, this is the one strategy everybody can use. The power, I was actually going to do a post on this today, so I won't do the post, and you guys can just have it. Right, here it is. The power of the word and. So a lot of times it's, this is happening, but blah, that means I can't do this, or this is whatever example. It can be just insert and into any difficult sentence you say or whatever you're describing. So I'm going through this really crappy situation, and I know that I'm still worthy of love and belonging. I'm going through this really difficult thing, and I know that I'm going to be okay. Like, and the power of the word and, I really probably can't express enough, because it allows for two opposing things to exist. And at the end of the one, the first thing in the sentence is the whatever you're going through, whatever situation. The second thing is always your self-worth. And I have adequate self-worth.
Yes.
That's what I said. It's really important to know that you're not going to feel good when you say that. You're not going to say this sentence. And I think that's where it's like something that therapy and psychology can go wrong is, I'm not telling you you're going to believe it. I'm not telling you you're going to feel good when you say it. So you can say the thing or whatever's going on in your life, and I have adequate self-worth. And I'm not saying that you're going to believe you have adequate self-worth in that moment, because you might be very low or things might be really hard. But you just got to keep saying it, because eventually it gets to a point where you might believe it, and then you start to believe it, and then you believe it. That's just really important. Because I think people go, well, it's not working, I don't feel it. Well, no shit. Like, it's not that easy, you know? So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
No, that's perfect. Because it's kind of like the same thing as this is like, we've talked a lot about grief in this podcast, and like the grief of losing a sport, the grief of retiring, the grief of losing someone, the grief of losing just something in your life. And you touched on it earlier and you said it, and it, I'm kind of bringing it back up, but like, I am grieving and I can still be happy. And I think that is, you know, especially with acceptance therapy, especially with, you know, aligning with a lot of things that we've touched on already. I think I don't really necessarily have a question, but I think for a lot of listeners that can relate to grief and that can relate to especially losing someone in their life, I know I always struggle with that shame of, why am I happy right now? Like, I should be grieving. I should be so sad. I should be crying my eyes out. I should be, you know, doing something that is not related to happiness or joy. And so for people listening and getting to that place of embracing that and accepting that, how do you possibly get to a mindset where you can say, I am grieving and I'm still allowed to be happy?
Okay. I really love that. First of all, thank you for sharing that, because that's deep and I love that. And it's something that isn't talked about enough. And what you're talking about is mixed emotions. The biggest energy sucker is mixed emotions, because it sucks all the energy out of us, because we don't know where to be and we think we need to be somewhere. Like, we think we need to either be, I'm sad or I'm happy. And then if I'm happy, but I want to be happy, this thing is, I'm with kids or I'm with friends or I'm golfing, I'm with the boys and things are great, we're chilling by a fire and everything's great, but I also should be grieving. And you feel guilty for it. And when you feel guilty, you feel like you're doing something wrong. And so then you're like, but I want it. But it just doesn't make sense, right? And the thing is, it actually makes sense. Because as human beings, scientifically, our brain is equipped to feel multiple things at one time. We strategically are not equipped to handle it unless we train the skill for it. So when you say, how do you get to a mindset? I don't know if you get to a mindset. I think you build skills and tools. It's the same thing if you're training on the ice. You need skills and you need behaviors that you engage. You need the skills. If you want to be a great hockey player, you need great skills. If you want to be a human being who lives a life of satisfaction and well-being, you need great skills in your arsenal. You need skills. And we just don't, I mean, we go to school and they don't teach us emotional skills, you know? And so that's it. I don't know if it's about getting to a mindset. It's about training skills. Having those skills in your bag to pull from when you need them. And you're always going to need them if you're a human being, which if you're listening to this, I'm sure you are.
Interesting you say, well, I got 2 points, because to tie in Ty's question a bit, and then also your answer, like, I think, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but some people mistaken like time for improving those skills. Like, it's enough time goes by maybe. Like, and then they think that they, once enough time passes, they're out of the hole. But it sort of just seems to me that I could be totally wrong. Like, I'm not a professional in this, obviously, but it seems like the feelings, if you're not equipped with the right tools and skills, they'll come up somehow later if you're not working on them. If you're just expecting, okay, time's going to go by, I'll eventually feel better.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you don't have to be a professional in this. No, I'm sure you guys know are much more fluid and aware of certain things that I'm not aware of, because you've had the experience as an athlete, you know, so it's not even, it doesn't matter how much training I have or letters behind my name, that doesn't mean anything. So I want to say that, but you're right. time can go by, but time doesn't mean shit unless you're implementing it and doing it.
Yeah.
And I'll give you the best example myself. Like, yeah, I'm an expert in this stuff, but sometimes I look at my own life, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? Like, come on. Yeah. It's because it is. Knowing is, this is another post I was going to make. So here you go. But knowing, actually I did make this one the other day. Knowing is one thing, but execution is an entirely different thing. They're two totally different things, but they are directly related. And the difference between somebody, I think, who lives a life of satisfaction and well-being, where they feel a sense of purpose and they can navigate life's trials and tribulations with some grace and eloquency, is the person who can execute. They know, and they can execute. Where sometimes I'm like, Alicia, do you just know and you don't execute? And some days it's like, yeah. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing? Get it together. You know? Yeah.
It's like the heart doctor that goes on a smoke break.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. It's not okay. Yeah.
Well, Alicia, I think, I can't speak for Riley, but I'm sure we could sit here for another 2 hours. And I think we might as well schedule an episode 2, because I know that we still want to touch on the parent side of things, the coaching side of things. There is so many more things that we would like to touch on. So for all of our listeners, there will be another one, because I think there was a lot of just value to this, and a lot of, I don't even know what to, like, Riley, I don't know if you want to kind of sum that up, but I think there was just a lot that people can just relate to and be like, kind of have that aha moment where it's like, oh shit. Yeah. Like that makes sense. So thank you for your being so candid and being so open, and for what you do. And yeah, Rouse, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'd love, Ty, I'll just, like, echoing you, I'd love to talk about, like, the curriculum thing too, like how, like, why isn't in school, and these little tools and stuff. Like, it could be a 30-minute class or something, but just giving kids some sort of backbone. But yeah, like, echoing Ty, I think too, like, if you're listening and some of this stuff is resonating, like, doesn't have to be Alicia. Like, there's a lot of people out there that can help you. And if some of the stuff is resonating, like, reach out. There's, like, therapists, there's people who are professionals on this subject for a reason. So, and then, yeah, Alicia, thank you. Like, this was awesome. I could talk to you all day. So it was great.
No, for sure. And I just want to say what you both are doing is awesome. It's needed. I actually, when you asked me the question about why hockey, I also, before hockey ever was a thing for me in this space, I care a lot and focus a lot and taught a lot about men's mental health. Because men, you know, that's a whole thing. And it matters. It matters for men. It matters how sons are raised. It matters for sons who become husbands and become fathers. And it matters for the men right now. You know, the suicide rate is highest in men for a reason. And so men's mental health means a lot to me. And even everyone's mental health does. But yeah, I think what you both are doing is amazing. It's very, very cool. So I'm glad we all connected.
Well, we appreciate you, and we will see you on the podcast again here shortly.
This episode is also brought to you by BioSteel. Zero sugar, essential electrolytes, great taste, and pure hydration. Join the likes of Connor McDavid, Alec Manoah, Andrew Wiggins, Brooke Henderson, and Patrick Mahomes on the BioSteel train. It's time for you to try BioSteel with our SYM25 discount code that will get you 25% off at checkout. Yep, that's right. I will gladly attest to this being the best hydration drink on the market. SYM25 at checkout.